Okay, welcome once again to another Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast, and I'm your host, Captain Kevin Smith, and I'm glad to be here. I'm here in our studios along with my great audio engineer who keeps me on track every week. This is a weekend radio show on Red State Talk Radio, right? Weekends. Great radio show, by the way. Radio station. That's what I meant to say. Radio station. We also are a podcast. You can find our podcast anywhere on all podcast platforms that we are aware of. And we've been doing this for quite some time. And we have a lot of archives. By the way, what's our website that we're using? Oh, okay. So now we have a landing page. What is that? That's a fancy term for a mega website. Is that it? Okay. So we're going to say that we have a landing page or a mega website, and the title or the name or the URL, however you want to call it, you know, how do you get to it? It's the sonicwarrior.com. That's where you go. All right. So if you want to know anything, you want to know anything about what? Throttle Up. You want to know anything about Substack. My weekly articles on Substack. You want to know anything about the Sonic Warrior videos. And on and on and on, by the way, we have new content all the time. Nothing is stale. We produce new content on a regular basis. We're very proud of being able to do that, by the way. And let me give you the address once again. And this is all one word that you just type. Is that correct? You type in one word in the search bar, right? My audio engineer is saying yes. So the what you type in is the Sonic Warrior. That's one word. All lowercase .com. So the Sonic Warrior .com, and that'll take you right to our what we call the landing page, and all of this other stuff is available to you. It's been recently updated, so just keep that in mind. We're trying to get a handle on this whole this whole media thing. Okay, did I cover everything? We have a new book, The Sonic Warrior, Chronicles of a Top Gun Pioneer, and we have a new film documentary, don't we? In fact, we just did an initial screening of that. What was it, yesterday? What did we do that? On Tuesday, right? We did it in St. George, Utah. Yeah, okay. So we did, was it St. George or Ivins? Well, close enough. St. George, Utah. All right. So, yeah. We have a new film documentary. This is like a big, big deal. And huge for us. We're very happy that we finally got it out into the marketplace. You can find the... How do they find it? They just go to YouTube? It's on YouTube. Yeah. Just
on your channel, right?
It's on the YouTube. My Sonic Warrior channel on YouTube, right? Mm-hmm. Just go to YouTube and type in The Sonic Warrior, correct? Yeah.
Well, done it,
I have. Yeah. I've done it. Yeah. Yep. Uh-huh. All right. So we'll do that. Okay. So let's start the show. This show is part of the Tip of the Spear series. We're going to be getting into some really critical stuff this week. So hang on to your hats, because this is not going to be a boring show. We're going to be rather a bit forceful here. We have to get our act together. We have to get ourselves in a position in which we can succeed. And we're not there yet. We're on the path to destruction, and so we need to get ourselves off that negative pathway and into a positive domain in which we can return to our what made America great, which is our ability to build things that really work, and they work extremely well. Our ability to build a military that not only works well, but that wins wars. Okay, that's what we're trying to get back to. All right, so here's the question from my great audio engineer for this week's show. Here she is.
Hello, Kevin, and hello to your listening audience. Okay, the title of this week's show is Elite Problem Solvers. And the question, the meta crisis is here. You talked about that last week. Now, what are we going to do? And you suggest four separate options at this point. Number one, do nothing. Number two, jump on a solution right away. Number three, give a speech. Number four, initiate an ad campaign. Now, what would you recommend, Kevin?
Okay, the first thing I would recommend is none of the above. And I'm not being flippant here. You probably think I might be, but I'm not. I'm dead serious here. My recommendation is to do none of the above. Let's get serious. Let's get down to brass tacks. And the other thing is this, and I'm headlining this show this week, and maybe in future weeks as well, we'll see. But I am definitely headlining this show as the show for Elite Problem Solvers, the show in which elite problem solvers can go. Or another way of putting it is, if you aspire to be an elite problem solver, then this is a great place to begin your journey. Right here on listening to this show, either on Red State Talk Radio or as a podcast, again, on all podcast platforms that we are aware of. So you have all kinds of ways to get it. Also, throttleupradio.com is our website for the podcast. But you, again, when I said just before, I'm going to remind myself to say it, and just remember, we do have a new landing page, and so that is thesonicwarrior.com. All right, go there, and then you can access all of the Throttle Up stuff as well as our podcast there and our books. You can access our books and our Substack articles. So that's a great place to go. Okay, what I'm going to be doing here is I'm going to be outlining for all of us, me included, because I kind of like this is more or less a gift to Kevin as well. All right? I'm going to be outlining the problem, or another way of saying that is I'm going to work very hard in problem definition. I'm going to try to clarify exactly what is the problem. And we all know what was attributed to Einstein, and I actually don't know if this is true. I kind of think it is, because I have gathered this from many sources. But years ago, Einstein was asked a question. The question kind of went like this. He said, the question was, if you only have an hour to save the world, what would you do? And his answer was quite remarkable. He said that he would spend the first 50 or 55 minutes trying to clarify or working to clarify the problem, and then the solution more or less falls into place. And he said the solution is nothing more than a set of mathematical equations which are easy, at least easy for him to develop. Okay, so 50 or 55 minutes on problem definition. And what we're going to be doing today is we're going to be clarifying what is the problem. If, in fact, we even suspect that we have entered the realm of the meta crisis, we have entered this time and place in this world, in this country, in which we are facing a meta crisis, which is, by the way, and we mentioned this last week, it is a collection of crises. It is more than a few. It is a large number of critical concerns. Another way of saying that is that it's a large number of critical operational concerns. If we are dealing with the operational or the operational aspect of our reality, operational aspect of our reality also includes the ability to build things and to install them in such a way that they actually perform a function for this country, for this culture, for this society. One of the things that we did have in place and was pretty good, it operated pretty well, is our supply chain. How is our supply chain doing now? Answer, not very good. It's not. Two, how is our manufacturing base doing? One, we're assuming that we have a manufacturing base, which we do. Two, then if we have one, how is it doing? How is it performing right now? The answer is not very good. Okay. Do we have a mechanism in which we produce young people or produce people who can enter the workforce and perform well in these two arenas or these two areas of the culture, these two areas of the economy, the supply chain and the manufacturing? No. How about the ability to perform operationally? How are we doing there? The answer is we're not doing very good either. Okay. So, and you don't have to take my word for it. We're going to be running We're going to be running a video. It's a video short video clip. Is that it? Okay. Yeah. We're going to be running a video here as soon as we get it up on the screen. And this happens to be Representative, how do you pronounce his last name? Matt Gaetz. All right. So this is Representative Matt Gaetz. He is talking. He is in the congressional chambers, and there is a meeting going on, or there is a discussion going on between Matt Gaetz and the Secretary of the Air Force. His last name is Kendall. I don't remember his first name. I apologize for that. So this is the Air Force Secretary, or Secretary of the Air Force, is being questioned by Representative Matt Gaetz. So let's go ahead and listen to this. This is really quite amazing. So let's carefully listen to this. It's about 5 minutes. It's well worthwhile. And let's go ahead and put that up right now. Okay.
The F-35 is our signature Air Force platform. What percentage of them are fully mission capable today? Mr. Secretary.
Congressman, if you give me a second, I'm going to pull out my card and give you an exact answer.
Okay.
55% is the number we have for operational availability.
Full operationally capable.
55% for operational availability.
Do you think that's a good number or a bad number?
I think that's not a good number.
Failing.
I wouldn't put it quite in that category.
I'd
ask General Alvin to comment on that. It's a number we'd like to see something.
Yeah, well, the reason I ask is because we got testimony that is a little contrary to that. Lieutenant General Schmidt, head of the F-35 program, gave testimony to the TAL subcommittee at HASC, and that testimony was that as of February of 2023, so a little over a year ago, only 29% were fully mission capable.
I think we need to talk difference between operational availability,
okay,
and mission capable.
Okay, so how many are fully mission capable today?
I do not have that number, but I would not dispute what the JPO has in front.
So
I would look
29%. So fully mission capable, 29%. You have no basis to dispute that, but you don't really know if it's true or false.
I have no basis to dispute it, but I would like to.
So you would agree that 55% is like a D, that 29% is definitely failing, right?
For fully mission capable, but
yeah,
the missions that they can accomplish.
I go meet with the folks at the 33rd at Eglin Air Force Base in the district I represent, and they're doing a lot of, you know, there's a lot of mission there. But like even the guys who are also at Eglin doing tests, they end up being at the very end, right? And I totally get why you want your operational squadrons to be the most capable, but then test gets put to the end, and then we're not meeting our needs. Like, I just think anyone watching this, one, would be surprised that you, General, don't know the exact percentage that are operationally capable. And two, I think people would be surprised that it's 29%. And this GAO report that I found on BreakingDefense.com that I seek unanimous consent to enter into the record, it says that the reason we are not capable is because you guys at the Pentagon have given too much power to Lockheed Martin and its subcontractors for sustainment. Do you believe Lockheed Martin has been given too much power on the sustainment of the F-35?
I believe that Lockheed Martin has more power than in some other weapon systems. They do have the contracted logistics system that was part of the procurement plan that was put in place 20 or some years ago.
Well, right. I mean, but it's not working. If the Lockheed Martin built the F-35, only 29% of them are fully operationally capable right now. We've all agreed that's failing. So now the question is, why is it failing? And this GAO report says the reason it's failing is because the fox is watching the hen house. Because the very contractor bilking the taxpayer for this platform is now in a position where they can't sustain it. Do you have a basis to disagree with that conclusion?
I have a long history with the F-35. And I inherited the program. I came into it in 2010. It was a few years into production at that point. And the first time I saw the program laid out, the schedule for it and so on, and when the decisions and points were going to be, the question I asked, and I'm going to quote myself, who's running this program, the government or Lockheed Martin? That's a quote from 2010.
I think you have your answer, Mr. Secretary.
And we set
Lockheed
up the
Martin.
Program, and it was originally set up under a philosophy of management called total system performance, which essentially gave to the prime contractor complete control of the program. We did not acquire the intellectual property to allow the government to come in and step in and control the program.
It sounds like
we are still fighting that problem today.
Well, right, but that is such important testimony for us to hear. Every member of the committee heard that. The government isn't running this program. Lockheed Martin's running this program.
That was a question I asked.
Well, it sounds like you got the answer. What's the answer to the question, Mr. Secretary, because only 29% of them are operationally capable?
We took a lot of steps to try to get that under control. I once imposed a production contract on Lockheed. I dictated a price to them because we couldn't get a negotiation done. I did a unilateral contract. Let them take me to court if they wanted to. They chose not to. put in place program managers who were very firm with the contractor and insisted on performance. We've had some conversations with the current head of the JPO, and we've had conversations with the CEO of Lockheed.
I appreciate those conversations. I've always found you to be a truth teller. You're always very honest with the committee and straightforward. The problem is the tail here is wagging the dog, and it's not going to get better unless there's accountability for the fact that their planes don't fly. I yield back.
Gentleman yields back.
Okay, wow, that was pretty hard-hitting, wouldn't you say? It was, and that is a great beginning to our efforts here on this show and other places to clarify the problem. Let us create a problem definition, and we're going to gather information in order to do it, in order to specify it very clearly, and in a way in which we can go from the clarified problem definition, or a better way of saying that is we go from the problem space to the solution space. The problem space is where we clarify the problem for which we are seeking a solution without specifying a solution. Then, after we do that, and we're very, very adamant about the fact that we do not specify a solution in the problem space. All we do is to work to try to fully understand the problem for which we desire a solution. Now, that is very, very important, and this requires a certain amount of mental discipline, a certain amount of, but an enormous amount of intellectual honesty going forward, and the willingness to tell the truth, or the willingness to acknowledge the truth. I have spent a good deal of time and put in quite a bit of effort in this area that I might call the truth, or what is the truth, or maybe a better way of saying that is I spent a lot of time in this area that I could call intellectual honesty. What we want to be honest, and we want to operate with integrity. Okay, that ought to be our hallmark. We go into and whatever endeavor we are dealing with, whatever space we enter, we should have out and open and clearly visible to all concerned that we are intellectually honest. We intend to be always intellectually honest, and we will always tell the truth. That's one of the things that Jordan Peterson talks about in his 12 Rules of Life. I think it's rule number 4, tell the truth, or at least don't lie. And he is quite adamant about the fact that we must, if we're going to survive as humans on this planet, we have to be able to not only recognize what the truth is, but we have to be willing, always willing and able to tell the truth. We have to always be willing and able to tell the truth. Now, that might get in the way of some kind of political agenda, but it doesn't matter. Okay? We will always tell the truth, and we will insist that others working with us on our team or community or whatever tell the truth as well. Okay, so We are in the problem space. We are creating a problem definition. Okay. Now, what we have is we have three companies that, or let's say three large industrial firms. These are mega corporations. These are the companies that form the foundation of our manufacturing sector. What are they? Well, there's a lot of them, but we have identified three. The first one is Lockheed, or Lockheed Martin, I think is what they go by now. The second one is Pratt & Whitney. And the third one is Boeing. Okay, so we have three very large manufacturing corporations, a part of our manufacturing industry. Just to be clear, Pratt & Whitney is now a division of RTX. So RTX now is the top of this mega corporation. So we have three. I might point out that General Electric is no longer a mega corporation. As of this week, General Electric Aerospace is its own company that has been spun off from whatever conglomerate it used to belong to, and now it is a separate corporation standing on its own, which happens to be standing in stark contrast to what Pratt & Whitney is right now. Pratt & Whitney is a component of what is called RTX. I have no idea what the heck is going on here. Nevertheless, Pratt & Whitney is a component. General Electric, which is their competitor in the marketplace of turbine engines, jet engines, and other places, other things related to that, is now a standalone company. And why did GE then go full circle back to a standalone company? They originally were a standalone company. They were building jet engines when I was flying jet fighters for the Navy. They were building jet engines for the Navy as well. Happened to be the J-79. That is a General Electric engine that powered the F-4 Phantom II. And it powered other airplanes as well. The F-4 Phantom was flown by the Navy, the Marine Corps, and the Air Force. So it was very prolific. Is that a good term? Prolific. It was in all three services. I did not personally fly the F-4. I flew a jet fighter that was more or less a contemporary of the F-4. At this time, the Navy had a dual fighter pipeline going. The reason for that was it was just a practical matter. The F-4 was too heavy and too big to operate on the smaller carriers that the Navy had in its inventory. And if you want to know the technical term, we can talk a little bit about the technical terms here and military speak. The Navy had a bunch of SX-class carriers, and they were all built during World War II. And after World War II, the Navy kept a number of these carriers going. So some of them did serve in the Korean conflict, but many of them were being used by the Navy in all kinds of ways, all the way up until, I think, the last Essex-class carrier deployment was the USS Oriskany, and that was in, I'm going to say, 1975. So between let's say 1960, a little bit before 1960. So the F-8 Crusader actually entered fleet operations with the Navy in 1957. And from there until, this is the fighter version now, and the tactical reconnaissance version. They both entered the fleet. The F-8 Crusader entered the fleet in somewhere in the area of 1957. And the fighter version stayed in the Navy until the last deployment of the Essex-class carrier, which was the Oriskany, until 1975. The tactical reconnaissance version kept going and did not retire from naval service until 1987. Okay, so the Navy had dual pipeline fighters for quite a while and had a single tactical reconnaissance airplane for a period of time until that mission was taken over by the F-14. Okay, so the Navy had two fighter pipelines, and they were both operationally capable. The big problem now is to recognize what exactly is the problem. Okay, what is the missing component here? The missing component in all three companies. We can talk about technology, we can talk about what they build, we can talk about how long does it take them to build and field or turn over the weapon system for the military to field it. How long does that take? We can talk about all of that stuff, but that's not, I think that clearly misses the point. What is the point? The point is that all three of these companies that I have mentioned here, Lockheed Martin, Boeing, and Pratt & Whitney, all three have lost something crucial in the marketplace. All three have lost their reputation. We're not talking about stock dividends. We're not talking about throughputs. We're not talking about anything, but all three have lost their reputation for being able to build airplanes that and engines that are safe, that are capable, and that are functional, and that are reliable. You heard testimony today during this congressional hearing that the F-35 built by Lockheed Martin is, in fact, not reliable. Okay, it is not. It is not a reliable weapon system. So it comes brand spanking new, comes into the fleet, and it cannot perform in a reliable way. In other words, there are reliability issues with it. Now, why in the world would you have something, you say, something as low-tech as reliability? I'm not sure how to phrase that, and I'm not going to put it into any kind of a pigeonhole or box. I'm just going to say from a broad standpoint, we want systems that are adaptable and resilient. We want systems, whatever the system is, whatever we are going to operate, we're going to first purchase it from our industrial base, and we're going to put it into operation. And we want it to be reliable, Okay, we want it to be resilient. In other words, if it has some difficulty, we can quickly fix it or get it fixed immediately, or apply corrective action in a very, very short period of time so that tomorrow it's ready to go again. Okay? Tomorrow it's ready to go again. Now, where's the model that we can look at? What is the model of reliability that we can look at? I don't know if this is true today, but I would say that it probably is. But the heavy equipment manufacturer called Caterpillar, they worked very hard over a very long period of time to build systems that are reliable, that could stay on the job for days, months, and years without breaking down. They did. They had extremely reliable systems. I used to be friends with a senior executive that worked for Caterpillar. I say used to be because he has since passed away. But that is a good model to take a look at. I'm going to read you something rather fascinating, so bear with me. This is happens to be a recent editorial in Aviation Week and Space Technology. This happens to be what's called Viewpoint. So this is an editorial under the heading of Viewpoint, and it is written by, and let me give you the date of this magazine so that you can get it. You can find it online, by the way, and get it. This is for April 8th to the 21st, 2024. Again, it's Aviation Week and Space Technology. And I would recommend every one of my listeners to locate this editorial and to read it. It is that important, because what we're trying to do here is we're trying to clarify the problem. What is this meta crisis problem that we desperately need to face? Now, here's where I'm going with this. Just going to give you a little bit of a heads up here. Here's where I'm going with this. I am going to propose, and in fact, I'm proposing right now, that we create a cadre of people in all industries that we call elite problem solvers. Okay? Do we have a cadre of seasoned professionals who are capable of complex problem solving? They are trained and experienced in the field of complex problem solving. If you want to know anything about complex problem solving, there's lots of places to go, including my new book, The Sonic Warrior, because I do have a chapter. Our chapters are called episodes, by the way, but I do have an episode in that book that is called, or it's entitled, Complex Problem Solving. This editorial is called A Viewpoint. It is by Anthony L. Villacoci, Jr., and he used to be the editor-in-chief of Aviation Week and Space Technology from 2003 until 2012. And I'm quoting here, okay, as welcome and overdue as the recent purge of Boeing's executive suite was, it will be some time before noteworthy signs of improved product quality metrics begin showing up. As the company slogs through the turmoil of its own foolish making, other manufacturers would do well to reflect on what they might learn from Boeing's disastrous descent into tumult and apply to their own operations. For any company that thinks such an idea has little merit, here are two inconvenient truths. First, at one time, no one could have conceived of Boeing being anything other than one of the most admired enterprises in any industry. Second, it is not every day that companies have an opportunity to study in real time the precipitous, I'm not sure I pronounced that right, the precipitous decline of an icon in their own industry. In this rare instance, companies can look on as though Boeing's downward spiral is happening in a vacuum, or they can assess whether the seeds of Boeing's problems could exist in their organization. For example, a glaring omission was the huge chasm between Boeing leadership and those working on the factory floor. All but absent was empathy for the rank and file, as well as the ability to inspire them to stay focused on the company's long tradition as a preeminent aircraft builder. If a stronger bond had existed between the two sides, it is very possible Boeing would not be running a distant second to Airbus today. Then there is Boeing's failure to apply lessons from the first 737 MAX crash in 2018, which offered clues that serious safety issues may have been more prevalent than first thought. Each succeeding production problem has been an unheeded clarion call because of Boeing's own culturally ingrained arrogance. How many other aerospace manufacturers lack formalized systems for capturing and disseminating lessons learned from mistakes? There are other areas where companies could find relevant lessons too. They include the oversight or lack thereof of Boeing's board of directors at the time of the two MAX crashes in 2018-2019. The board included one engineer and various political appointees. Since then, it has remained a largely ineffective governing body. Another source of problems was the company's decision not just to outsource critical subsystems, but also to allow key system suppliers to perform design work. The initiatives were part of a broader cost reduction strategy, but in its implementation, Boeing sacrificed much of the close collaboration between engineers essential to building a high-quality product. Risk management effectively took a back seat, which was compounded by how executive compensation packages were structured. Leaders got caught up in share price appreciation driven by cost reductions that they marginalized or compromised other business fundamentals at the operating level. The company's emphasis on near-term profits over quality also discouraged investment in new and innovative product development, while Airbus pursued a more strategic vision. Okay, I'm going to stop right there for the moment, and I'm going to mention a couple of more things here before the end of the show. We're getting close to the end of the show here. And I'll pick up this editorial, this great editorial next week. I did want to kind of like segue into the F-35 issue that was being discussed during his congressional hearings. I think it was yesterday. It might have been the day before, but very, very recently this was a congressional hearing, by the way, with the Secretary of the Air Force. So, what is going on with the F-35 Lightning II? All right, the F-35 Lightning II is a multi-mission and multi-service airplane. It's an airplane that has a Air Force version. It's an airplane that has a Marine version. And it has an airplane that has a naval version. Okay, so there are three different versions. Now, why would you want to do that? I have no idea. Okay, commonality, if that's the key. Commonality is supposed to give you a very high level of readiness. So commonality is not just for its own sake. Commonality is supposed to give you readiness. If for some reason there's all kinds of justifications for it, none of them are convincing to me, by the way. I don't buy it. I simply don't. I was responsible as a squadron commander deployed on the USS Constellation. I was responsible for readiness as well as a whole bunch of other things, and I didn't see where the commonality with anything was worth anything at all. There was much other important factors in play. So, the operational readiness of the F-35 is at 55%. Here's a brand new airplane right off the factory floor when it is delivered to the squadrons, the Air Force. And we're going to look at the Air Force. This was focusing on the Air Force, but nevertheless, when it's delivered to the Air Force squadrons, it cannot be maintained. Okay, operational readiness of 55% and full mission capable readiness is only 29%. This is a brand new airplane that is delivered to the operational community, and it can only perform all of its missions less than 30% of the time. Why in the world would you want to have that as a frontline fighter? Why in the world can't we just switch gears here and say the first and foremost thing, beyond any technological aspect of this system, comes reliability, resilience, and agility. Okay. And agility also involves surge capability or sprint capability. A 29% mission capable is atrocious. I would agree that that is a grade of an F. Right, so something has got to be done, right? And it's not something that we can just delay. My position is this. Let's just say, okay, we are going to employ our elite problem solvers right now. We're going to do it. We're going to gather our wits about us. We're going to get the money, get the emergency funding right away, and we're going to deploy our elite problem solvers across the board in every squadron, in every squadron space, in every aircraft carrier, in every air wing, in every Marine Corps air station. We're going to send our elite problem solvers out there. We're going to go into the manufacturing community, and we're going to send our elite problem solvers out there, and we're going to figure out how we can fix this problem. We're not just going to wring our hands and just say that we have a big problem here, but we don't know what the solution is. We've got to make sure that we clarify what the problem is and then bring our best and the brightest into the solution space. Okay? That's what we need to do. We can also bring in some experts to help us clarify the problem. There's a number of great companies that do that, by the way, that work on a regular basis for the Department of Defense. We can bring them in as well. We can say, can you help us with a problem definition? And then we can start finding, we can activate our solution initiative immediately by deploying these elite problem solvers across the board. I just got a hand signal from my great audio engineer, and she said I've got less than, 30 seconds to go? What is it? So we're at, I could go on for quite a bit longer. All right, so we'll pick this up again next week. We'll finish my train of thought on next week's show and hopefully other shows as well going forward. This is a very important subject matter. It's a very important issue that I am dealing with. Maybe it's the most important issue that we have ever had on Throttle Up Radio Show and Podcast. All right, so thank you all for listening, and we will see you all next week.